On today's episode of Hollyweird Paranormal, the date is August 9th, 1969. LAPD is called onto a very gruesome scene at 10050 Cielo Drive. The bodies of Sharon Tate, her three closest friends, and her unborn child are found brutally murdered. Who's to blame? Charles Manson and his family. Fast forward 30 years later, David Oman purchases property 300 feet from where the murders occurred, builds his dream home, and soon discovers that he is not the only one living at his house. Stories of full-body apparitions, footsteps, and voices can be seen and heard throughout his home. Could this be the victims of the Sharon Tate murders? Or is it something a little more sinister? This is the true crime and paranormal aftermath of the Sharon Tate Manson murders. Hey guys, welcome to our first episode of Hollyweird Paranormal. We are your hosts, Tammy Merhep Chavez
and Bryce Mitchell Williams.
Welcome to Hollyweird Paranormal. So pretty much what we're going to do is break the ice real quick and do a little introduction of what this podcast is about, what you're going to listen to in the future, and who are the voices pretty much behind the mics here. So real quickly, Hollyweird Paranormal is a Hollywood true crime and paranormal podcast based out of Los Angeles, California. So we're going to cover true Hollywood crime and the paranormal aftermaths of those crimes. And trust me, there are a ton of them in the city of Hollywood and its surrounding cities that make up this crazy state of California that we live in and love, of course. So Bryce, do you want to go right ahead and pretty much explain what is Hollyweird? Definitely. Like, what is that lingo? Where does it come from?
I think, well, I have a little personal anecdote about it, and then I think also that segues in, but I always think of the quote, and I, of course, will never remember who said it, so we'll Google that later. Follow us on Twitter so that we can tell you what it is.
Of course.
But there's a saying, and it's, if you turned the country on its end, all of the weirdos would shake out to Hollywood. And I think that is the perfect sort of start.
That is so cool.
Because it's so true. The things that you see here on a daily basis would be front page news anywhere else.
Oh, of course.
Because it's so weird or out of the norm, and you just sort of become like, oh yeah, that's just Hollywood. The number of times I've said that, just like, oh, that's just Hollywood. And I think that's
nothing
what
shocking.
It is never, you know. And it's this idea for me of this town that has been built on an industry that is based on a lot of chaos. I mean, it's a lot of luck, there's a lot of hard work and a lot of tears and a lot of advantage being taken of other people, and that kind of boils into this like soup of sorts of where all this energy manifests itself. And so sometimes that's paranormal, sometimes that's interpersonal with people just losing it and all of a sudden they've snapped and this horrifying thing happens. And it's all these things that kind of, you know, sometimes it's great too, sometimes you know, I'm not trying to make it seem horrible, but I think when I think of Hollyweird, it's the things that we normalize about this crazy city that is really the bloodline of this area. I mean,
I agree.
Yeah. So that's for me, I think, just the things that are weird that we normalize. And then you start thinking like, no, I shouldn't be seeing a ghost. Like, that's not normal.
Yeah. Or a guy holding a knife walking down the street.
Yeah. All of it.
Which has happened
many times.
And it's so funny, guys, because Bryce and I, we work together in the heart of Hollywood.
Yes.
We work together in a very interesting location. We can't really give out the details because of confidentiality reasons. We'll get in trouble. But I guess let's call it the Big Fancy School. We're just going to call it Big Fancy School.
The BFS. All right.
This school is so fancy. Aside from its astronomical tuition, the school itself was owned, and this person used to reside on this property was Charlie Chaplin. Mm-hmm. And his buildings, like the actual like structures, like his houses and everything else, they're still on that property.
Yep.
And trust me, there's a lot of crazy stories about our
job. We just had a dormitory built a year ago, and we're hearing crazy stories about that dorm too. People seeing like a shadow person, and trust me, guys, we're going to be doing an episode on that. It is crazy. But yeah, it's funny because for people that are not too familiar with Hollywood, they think, oh, I'm going to come to Hollywood and I'm going to see a star. Yeah, back in the 40s, it worked.
Yep.
Unless you're doing yoga in Hollywood, you can. I used to do yoga religiously at this place called Core Power Yoga. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day I walk into class. Oh, there's Colin Farrell doing, you know, the HPF class. And then the next week it was, oh, Christopher Pratt, you know, doing yoga sculpt. And then the following week was Drew Barrymore. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you're not going to see them walking down Hollywood Boulevard. No. You might see like those little characters trying to portray them, you know. But
well, I think there's this idea that is like definitely fostered by televised Hollywood events.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with, like the red carpet and the Oscars and all of that. It's like, yeah, they work for a month clearing out the chaos of everyday Hollywood to glam it up.
Yes.
But yeah, if you've made it, you're in Beverly Hills. You're in the hills. You're not living in Hollywood. That's a whole different
That's sort a whole of ball game. Yeah, mentality of what you see.
But and shows. Then kind of going back to that is that it is built though on the foundation of where the industry did used to be. So you have these sort of layers of like modern day chaos and filth, more or less. Mm-hmm. On top of, you know, like you were saying, the orange groves where the Charlie Chaplin studio was and all these like places where they were shooting, where the studios were, the original location of the Oscars, all of these things. And those layers leak out through each other. And I think that's sort of what happens is all of a sudden you're like, well, why would this be happening here? Like, it's a modern area. Like you were saying, we just built this. It's a new building.
Yeah.
But it's on a foundation of old school chaos. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Which we're going to segue.
Segue.
Into episode one, guys. We're going to be talking about the true crime and paranormal aftermath of the Sharon Tate, Charles Manson murders. I was about to say Marilyn Manson.
No, that's a Everybody's whole different episode.
No, yes, trust me. But it's so funny that you said that because in this episode where her house, you know, was standing, where the murders occurred and where David Oman's house was built, it has a lot of crazy history. So we're going to jump into that very, very, very soon. But yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason of this podcast is to pretty much talk about what a lot of people would consider weird, the paranormal, true crime. I love aliens. I love a good alien story. You know, everything from like Bigfoot to even like skinwalkers. We're going to have it all here in this podcast.
And so. It's all happening in this city. That's the thing. It's like, we don't even really have to look too far out. It's not like we're, you know, well, it's on the West Coast. Like, a lot of it's happening in our backyard. And that's like, I think what you don't always realize, like, oh, well, lots of areas in the country or in the world have these kind of stories. Like, yeah, I don't know that anywhere's quite so localized. Like, oh yeah, down the block. Cool.
Yeah, like down the block, there's that haunted house. Yeah. Just see like weird orbs around there, man. Yeah.
It's fine. It's great. It's fine.
You want to go get that latte? Yeah.
Yes, sure. I do. No ghost will stop me from coffee.
So. Oh, hell. Which, by the way, we have our Starbucks.
Yes, just slurping them down.
Look, my husband and I have the gold card because we pretty much have a license to be a basic bitch.
Yeah.
This is so bad.
And I won't apologize.
No. So, Bryce, you want to talk true crime?
I want to, yes.
Let's start with the true crime of Sharon Tate and the Manson family. Go right ahead.
Great. So, one of the craziest parts of this is how sort of cliche her start is.
Yeah.
I'm going to start by talking about Sharon Tate as a person first, and then we'll, like, obviously jump into how their paths intertwined and why they were murdered and all of that. But for her story specifically, I mean, she's such an interesting person on her own and her like rise to stardom.
Oh yeah.
I think there's like that weird obsession that we have with like raise yourself up by your bootstraps, heartland actress type stories. And that's like her exact cliched kind of thing. She like was born in Texas. She wins a beauty pageant, not to like gloss over her early life, but you know, and that sort of catapults her into this world so quickly,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, many people come here and they're struggling and it's the daily grind. And for her, so one of the things that I like was instantly like shocked by, I had no idea, is that once she won these pageants in Texas, that is like what really starts the thing. And she comes from a very normal family, but all of a sudden is getting all of this recognition for being, you know, that creepy child pageant winner.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so, you know, now we see that and it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of cliche, but at this time, she's like one of the, not first, but just one of the fastest. And it's so crazy. So, you know, they're moving around, but she, in all of these different states. So it's like Texas, it's Washington, her family's moving around, her dad was in the military. And everywhere they go, it's like people recognizing her, like, growing charisma, I guess. Which I find really creepy that we, like, fetishize that in young women especially. But
yeah, because she was very, very beautiful.
Yeah, and, like, it makes sense, especially for where the industry was at the time.
Yeah.
I think we are sort of hopefully transitioning out of that, I think, in a perfect world. But at the time, especially, that was, like, if you were a woman, that was your lot as an actress. Like, you better be stunning. And she was, and it's obviously worked out very well for her, mm-hmm. more or less. So she basically grows up, moves to Los Angeles. It's, like, time. She's going to do the whole, like, acting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically starts stringing together these, like, small parts. And then, what was her first... Sorry. So she's in the Steve McQueen world, I think, is a good place to start, too.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
That was a huge, huge ordeal.
So, right, she's stringing together, like, these small TV parts. Mm-hmm. She's getting recognition. She's very attractive. And then she's in and starts working with Steve McQueen, who at the time is, like, the person.
He was Brad Pitt back then. In still the, is. You know, like, still, like, I know, oof, like, he's still looking.
Hey, Steve McQueen. I would not mind being haunted by him.
No, I agree. Like Bullet Haunt, like, yeah, you like, can, like, Steve McQueen.
Please stay, thank you. So basically it's just the rise is so meteoric for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's, I wonder too, we do that thing as a society where once someone dies, we sort of canonize them or.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, because all of the things I've seen her in obviously occurred after her death.
Yeah.
So I always wonder, like, how iconic she was, but now she is so iconic because of, you know, so you see her in these movies, you're like, oh, she's like this young starlet.
Yeah.
I think there is an element that is a little bit exaggerated posthumously, but I think that there still is an element of her really being like the new girl in town, the new face, and starts getting a lot of work because of that. Oh,
yeah. She starts like smooching with like the right people. She even becomes friends with Mia Farrow at one point.
Right. Yeah. Which is so crazy. And then, of course, like her and Roman Polanski.
Oh, yeah.
Which again becomes this weird, like.
Anything with that man is weird.
Yes, that is the moral of this story, is that if it's involving him. And so, of course, then like. The love, not triangle per se, but just their very close relationship. Because her and Mia Farrow were such close friends.
Yes.
And obviously her and Roman Polanski were married. And then obviously later, we all know what happened with Roman Polanski and Mia Farrow and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably a different episode.
Oh. Yes, it is.
So, you know, they work together. They're not immediately that fond of each other. He's apparently, like, hyper-critical of her, which I think is, like, that old school Hollywood, like Alfred Hitchcock, like, you're mean to your leading actress. I don't know why that was a thing, why they needed to like put down their actresses, but like I think that mindset of like that's how you get the performance out of them was very prevalent. So they were in is this the right one? Yes, so they're in Fearless Vampire Killers. And he's like hyper critical of her. He like isn't happy with the way it's going, and she really is having a hard time working with him, and it's like not a good start. But then as they like progressed, he like sort of reverses his chaos towards her and like starts praising her for like how amazing she is, and she kind of becomes his like weird muse in a way. This like 180 degree turnaround of like, you are being torn down by this man, and now he's like obsessed with you, and just like everything that you're doing, he's like altering the movie around her performance, basically, which is so crazy because that kind of wasn't really done at the time. Mm-hmm. More or less, he makes her career, you know what I mean, because he becomes so obsessed with her.
He molded her
100%.
It sounds like almost like a Svengali effect.
Yeah that's such a good example, and it's just so quick at that point. And you know, then they fall in love, and who can even say like how, like where does the art stop and the love begin, or vice versa? It's all so wrapped up in this relationship now where they're working together, but they're married. Mm-hmm. I think he was very obsessed with her, not necessarily in a bad way, but just she was his whole world, professionally, personally, becomes this whole separate entity almost.
Now, wasn't she younger than him?
Yes.
Like, how many years? Because I know homeboy has some like interesting taste in not women, we could call, girls.
Yeah,
very young girls, like pedophile. Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't write down their, let's see, so when she was in the movie, she would have been, you're making me do math on the spot. She would have been,
drink more coffee.
I know, right? 19, is that right? Am I doing that math right?
No, she was fairly young. I would say that she was in her early 20s.
Yeah, if she was 25, I'll eat this microphone. There's no way. Because she was 16 when she moved to LA, and that was in 62, is that right? Doing math on the spot. If that's why you came to this podcast, you've come to the wrong spot, because I will not be your math guide, I promise you. Yeah, it looks like she would have been 22 about. So, again, that's like, what, a 30-year difference?
Yeah, that is a major difference.
And again, it goes back to that thing of you're young and you're wanting to break in, and it's just you are open to predatory behavior. Yeah. Or you minimalize it, or, you know, it's obviously all that we're seeing now in the news. Mm-hmm. But this is how it starts, where it's just like, but you're being told by this, like, very famous person who's directing the movie you're in how amazing you are. And all of a sudden, it's, like, more than a professional relationship. Again, whether or not, who can say? At this point, a lot of what we know about her and about this time is from his account and from Mia Farrow's account. So who can say? I like to think that it wasn't horrible and creepy, but it's such an aggressive age gap. She was nominated for a Golden Globe, which at the time is like, obviously, you've made it, right? Like,
yeah,
that's what everyone wants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's hard because you see these like discrepancies between their personal lives and their private lives. And I mean, on the one hand, they look like you said, the perfect Hollywood couple, and they're both successful and their life is so glamorous and this house is so majestic. And then also like their marriage is falling apart, more or less. That's purely speculation. Dear Polanski Foundation, please don't sue me. Thank you. Yes, so they do. They're both overseas some. She's filming some. And then do you want to talk about the house itself, or do you want to jump right into...
We could jump right into what happened on technically August 8th or 9th of 1969. Mm-hmm. You could even give a broad overview of the Manson family, too, and go from there.
Ooh, well... The Mansons, yes.
Such a great family.
Yes, really, like, all American.
Like, they got their shit together.
Wholesome.
I know.
Never. No, I'm just kidding. yes. Basically, so she's pregnant. Let's start there.
Okay.
Which I think makes this all so much more horrifying for me.
Yes. It's just, so the picturesque world that she's living in, it's gonna, you know, pretty much come to a very violent end.
Right. And so she is having people over,
mm-hmm.
and she is mad, more or less. It's because she's alone. So she had come back to Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and Roman Polanski had not, I think, is sort of why she was having people over.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes that thing of, like, it wasn't just her, it was all these people around her who are also then murdered,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, very brief over and spoilers, but it's the fact that she's pregnant, and, like, they count the unborn child as a murder. It's just also violent and graphic and shocking, because it's, this is not where or whom this happens to.
No.
And it's, I think, you know, so jarring.
Yes.
Because of that, because she was safe, quote unquote. I mean, she's in the place in the city. She's the kind of person. They're wealthy enough. They're famous enough that this should not have happened to them.
And in the manner that it, you know,
mm-hmm.
that it happened. Because I know, like, jumping a little bit ahead, mm-hmm. because, like, this murder, it has been stated by many people that this was the murder that changed the 60s. Charles mm-hmm. Manson is the guy that forever, like, changed the 60s. Mm-hmm. He instilled so much fear into people.
Yes.
And after this happened, it was just, like, all hell broke loose.
It really is, and it sort of defines the era. And when I think of any kind of, like, cult killings or serial killings or any of that, like, true crime,
mm-hmm.
it, the 60s and 70s are just a hotbed.
Oh, yeah.
For that. You can't really separate the two.
Whole story is the perfect mm-hmm. recipe for, oh my God, media to run rampant. Mm-hmm. It was just, it's just so famous. I even remember my mom telling me the story when I was in high school. That's why I wanted to do this as the first episode. I've always been intrigued, but you have everything. You have a fallen starlet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have her married to a, you know, very famous director.
Yes.
They have, you know, a very interesting, you know, setup and marriage. And then you have Charles Manson and his family.
Family
you have cult members. You have cult members tripping on freaking acid. Mm-hmm. And then, boom, the murders start occurring.
And it is, you know what's so weird, too, is that it all was like a minute from not happening. It's mm-hmm. that weird thing where the stars aligned, pun intended. And, you know, they were out. They were at dinner. They were back home. They came. And then they all just happened to be, they just all showed up. And the Mansons were there. Mm-hmm. And like you were saying, so much of it was like drug fueled, or that was their defense, more or less, like in later years. But I think they knew that they were doing. And it just all of a sudden, basically from like midnight on, it's just very, it's one and done. That's it. There's no, I think the last they were seen out at dinner around like 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then by midnight, they were all murdered. So just that quick of a turnaround of just like right place, wrong time. And it's just so horrifying. And so she was stabbed, and so was her baby or her uterus, however you'd prefer to say that. Then her friends were shot in the driveway. So it's like this progression through the house. There's, you know, you're so far in the hills, like no one even finds them until the next day.
Yeah.
And it's the housekeeper. Like, how does she even deal with finding that scene of just like, the further she goes in the house, the just worse carnage, the just horror gets.
Carnage. So, real quickly, let's go over, like, what happened on August 9th, that hour that the Manson family, like, made their way to the driveway, I guess you can say.
Timeline-wise, on August 8th into the morning of August 9th, basically, the five, they come home from dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So, the murders that the Manson family has been accused of are the five plus one person who was visiting the home, which, like, what an unfortunate, like...
Yes, that was, I believe his name was Stephen Parent.
Yes. So, basically, he was visiting, and got kind of caught up in all of this, which is just so heartbreaking to me that mm-hmm. like, and the main thing is that this is not like a personal vendetta against, it has nothing to do with any of the people who are currently there.
No.
It's all in retaliation from Charles Manson being like mad about not being a musician.
Yeah.
And so he sends his family, I keep saying that, but I feel like maybe we need to address the fact that it's like his cult members.
Yeah, he sends his people.
It's not his sister that's doing this. It's the people that are in his cult.
Right.
And says to them, go to the house, which used to be this music producer's, mm-hmm. and kill everyone that's there. And, you know, their whole goal was to shock the world. And so he basically commands them to do it in the most graphic way possible. Mm-hmm. So he's the mastermind, but technically he's not there. So it's Susan Atkins, Linda, and I'm sorry if I say their names wrong, Kasabian and Patricia Krenwinkel. Mm-hmm. And then they are there with Tex Watson, who's like the right-hand man, telling the women what to do, which I find so obscene, the thought of like, A, getting people to do your dirty work for you, and then for some reason it's so... like a woman killing a pregnant woman is so violent, and you're clearly making such an aggressive statement,
right,
in that choice. So that, I think, was their goal, was to really get people to know who they were, to notice them, and to be shocked, like you were saying, like era defining, to be shocked by what they were willing to do. So the five of them come home from dinner. Then they... around midnight, basically, is when it all begins. And so Jay Sebring, mm-hmm. was also one of them, who was a writer. So Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, who is of Folger's Coffee,
yes, randomly. Yes, the coffee heiress.
They're all coming home from dinner. And... So Watson gets there and cuts the phone line. So basically now they're unknowingly cut off from the world in this secluded mansion fortress, more or less. Like, yeah. Right? They're just so alone. They don't know it. Why would you check your phone line? And then he has the women hide in the bushes to, like, prepare. And that's when Stephen Parent gets involved, because he is visiting the pool house where the caretaker lives, mm-hmm. and so they cross paths because they're hiding out, more
they're
or
hiding
less.
Out, yeah.
And so they point the gun at him as he's like trying to leave the property, mm-hmm. and he's begging them. I mean, again, not to be super graphic, but it's such a violent murder, you sort of have to talk about,
yeah, I mean, this happened
the way that it did. It happened, and it was intentional. I think, you know, it's not a crime of passion.
No,
they're intentionally being as violent as possible.
They had it planned to the teeth.
Yes. And so he's begging them. Watson rushes at him and stabs him and then shoots him 4 times. So he has a lot of defensive stab wounds, but eventually what kills him is the shooting. She shoots him. And then that's sort of the start of it. And so they're pushing the car farther up the driveway, so he's the first victim. They like met him at the pool house. And then they're now looking for a way into the home, any window that's open, and they end up cutting their way in. Mm-mm. And that's where they kill the next two, or I'm sorry, that's where he like then lets the women into the home, so they now they're inside,
they made themselves at home.
Yeah, literally.
Literally.
Ooh.
I know.
And so they wake up. Frykowski is like sleeping in the living room, and so they start attacking him. He's like the first in the home, and he's asking them, who are you? Mm-hmm. And they basically say, like, we're the devil. We're like here to cause chaos. Which, what a terrifying, like, who are you? Oh, I'm the devil.
I'm
like,
the devil. Tell me this is a dream. I just woke up on the
right,
couch.
Right, but you're being assaulted while this is happening. So it's like this very violent awakening. And so while he's being beaten, the women go through the house to round everyone up, essentially, like livestock, more or less. And that was, I think, their mindset. And so They're all brought into the living room, and the women begin tying. They're all being tied together by their necks and sort of like strung up over the beams in the ceiling. So not, they're essentially being hung.
Yeah.
So Sebring, he starts protesting and saying, like, she's pregnant, Sharon Tate's pregnant, like, please don't hurt her, please stop, like, strangling her. Mm-hmm. And because of his protest, he's the next one to be killed outright. Ugh. And so they beat him with the pistol, and they shoot him, and then they stab him until he dies. So that's the second, like, death. And again, just because he happened to, like,
Speak up. Yeah.
And so they are trying to fight their way back to get out of this horrifying situation. And the more they fight, that's like how the violence is then targeted.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's almost like they're egging them on a little
bit. A little
more.
Bit, yeah.
It's like they're, you know, making the aggressors even more aggressive.
Yes. And it's so, like, you're. Survival instinct, of course, is kicking in.
Yeah.
And then that's like making you the next target. Mm-hmm. So Farkowski, he's the next one that then is stabbed and shot twice because he escaped like the ties that they had him in. Mm-hmm. And then so they kill him. And then the groundskeeper who the
yeah
the
where is he during
so
all
so that's
this.
The thing is like this sprawling manor,
yeah,
he comes up because he hears the chaos. He didn't realize that his like friend or I mean who knows what it was, right? Like salacious.
It was the 60s.
Yeah, come on. So he goes to the house and he's the next victim because he enters this death scene now.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes because he's like trying to find out what these horrible sounds are, and he's then killed. And so two of them, they get out towards like there's like a pool, like the lanai area.
Mm-hmm.
And they're tackled to the ground from behind, which like just that you're so close. Oh man, they like almost get out and then they're tackled and stabbed
yeah.
to death.
And that was, who was that? It was like Abigail Folger.
So that was Folger and Krenwinkel. They mm-hmm. both got out and then they are just massacred. So they get tackled. And then I think one of them, yeah. So one of them, Farkowski was stabbed 51 times.
Jesus.
I mean, at that point, the violence has now taken over. Mm-hmm. Like the first one, he was shot and stabbed once. The next one shot. And then stabbed a few times. By this point, they're just stabbing. It's the rage has taken over, or the drugs, or whatever.
Yeah.
But they're no longer human in that moment. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so that, he was stabbed 51 times. And, like, horrifyingly, Sharon Tate's the last one.
Right.
So she is not only witnessing all of this, she is begging for her life. She's begging for her child's life. She's trying to ransom her life. For the life of her child.
Mm-hmm.
She's, you know, again, this is all through their reports and alleged information, but she's saying, like, let me just live long enough to have the baby, and then you can kill me. All these just, I mean, desperate, horrifying last moments of just, like, trying to protect the one thing that you have.
Mm-hmm. Which is your child.
Which is your child. I mean,
mother bear.
And this all goes back to, like, you know, you have this picturesque life, you have this child, mm-hmm. and now it is violently being ripped away from you. And so she's begging for the life of her child. And as we know, like that, she was then stabbed. And they stabbed her 16 times. And, you know, all of her pleas, but more or less fell on deaf ears.
Mm-hmm.
And they stabbed her, and they were also charged with the death of her unborn child, which is just so gruesome and horrifying and inhuman to me.
I know. And I even saw, like, if you go online, if you really want to get weird and dark.
If this hasn't been graphic enough for you.
I know. This hasn't been graphic. If you go online and research and even look on the images, there are mm-hmm. post-mortem pictures mm-hmm. of the crime scene, of the victims. And it is a complete bloodbath.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing, is that they were instructed not only to be as violent as possible, but to be as jarring as possible. Mm-hmm. And so they take one of the towels that they had like tied them up with, and they write pig on the front door. Ugh. And so that, first of all, is just so insensitive, or just, you've just detached yourself so completely to be able to just use the blood of the chaos you've just caused. But on top of that, just shows their mindset of how far in these women had really gone, that they're like, we are going to dehumanize this situation as much as possible. And that was under his direction, under Manson's orders, more or less. And so they write that, and that, I think, sparks the speculation of how people realized what had happened. Not just that it was a mass murder, not that it was an accident, any of that. This was intentional, this was violent, and this was orchestrated to be shocking.
It was. This is what Charles Manson called Helter Skelter.
Yes.
This was the beginning of it.
And so they sort of want to usher in this new era of anarchy, chaos, violence, murder, all of these things. And this was like the, in their mind, the spark of it. Mm-hmm. And it's just so horrifying.
It was. It was such a scene. And I remember even reading the reports online. The cops that showed up there had, you know, seen things in war. They are war veterans. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we've never seen anything ever like this. In our, you know, 20 or 30 years in the force, we've never seen anything like this ever, especially coming out of that area, because this was an area of, like, you know, wealthy, you know, stars. It was a gated community. Nothing bad happens here, and this happens, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing that's so crazy, is so they're, I think the whole city and then very quickly the country is so rocked by this.
Yeah.
Because it's so unheard of. Because at the time,
people that they're reading about in the tabloids and the news are gone.
Yes.
Are completely gone. And it is a big, big shock. Mm-hmm. Especially in a city like, you know, Los Angeles. And to be even more graphic, guys, like American Horror Story Cult this past season, they did a episode of this particular murder scene. And, I mean, that was the whole purpose of the series, was it was about cults. They did an episode about, you know, Heaven's Gate. Mm-hmm. And then they finally did one of Charles Manson. And Sarah Paulsy plays...
Paulson.
Exactly. Thank you, Sarah Paulson. She plays Susan Atkins.
Oh, wow.
And she, like, the makeup, everything. That girl was on. You believe that she was Susan.
I mean, she's, like, the greatest actor.
Oh, so. Yes. Ugh. And I think his name is Peter Evans. He's the main guy in all the series. Right. He portrays pretty much all the leaders of these cults in this particular season. And he plays Charles Manson in this one, of course, and he knocks it out of the park. But that whole scene of them breaking into the house, murdering everyone inside, it was intense. Yeah. Intense. It was very graphic, but it just pretty much shows the audience, like, this actually happened, that a man was able to control this, that Charles Manson was convicted of these murders without even being there.
Well, and that's committing them. Yeah. Yeah. And it's so crazy because, as you know, so they're convicted, they get caught, they're arrested for car auto theft of all things. And then as it starts coming out, and they never waver. And that, I think, is what's so terrifying about all
like
of it.
Like, they're not fazed. They're just completely reticent. Like, no, they remorse. Did a good deed.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. There's a correlation how you once described, like, in the very beginning, you said Sharon Tate's and Roman Polanski's relationship was kind of... It was very, very severe in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like, it was very stern. He was very, very hard on her. It's the same parallel as Charles Manson with these women. And trust me, he didn't have one woman. He had several.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember even seeing, I think it was a show or a movie. It was called Helter Skelter. It was all based on the family and how the family, like, you know, became the Manson family and everything. But it was a very intense show because, I mean, he was so abusive towards them so loving. He was so, God, he was so narcissistic. Mm-hmm. So narcissistic. I mean, he is a narcissist. He's, you know, a complete, you know, psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
And these women, like, just fell at his feet, would do anything mm-hmm. for him.
And so I think that is the one of the saddest parts for me, too, is mm-hmm. that then the aftermath, in a slight transition, of how Roman Polanski and Mia Farrow, especially the two of them, move forward mm-hmm. in the grieving process. And, I mean, Mia Farrow especially is in, like, a one-woman war against this family to keep them in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is subjecting herself to every time one of them was up for parole, having to go through the graphic details of what happened to her very close friend
mm-hmm.
who was pregnant, who was with many of their other friends.
Right.
In order to testify against them, in order to keep them in prison. I just think it's such a touching tribute to the memory of her friend.
Of course.
That she would do that, that she would take that on and, you know, fight that fight of, no, this will never be forgotten.
No.
And this can never be excused, because they were completely remorseless. I mean,
they were. I mean, there's recordings of them, like actual recordings. I sent you that Dateline.
I know
video. So there's this really great episode, guys. I'll put it on the blog. But there's a video of them literally, like they're walking outside of the court or mm-hmm. walking into the courtroom, hand in hand,
that
singing and
iconic
smiling
image of them walking,
like,
hand in hand.
We did this. Like, no, that was us. Mm-hmm. Like. You know, it was so insane. And of course, Mia Farrow is going to be the one that is going to fight for her mm-hmm. friend, because she had to deal with this, and she also had to deal with the tabloids.
Oh my God!
At first, from when I like researched, the tabloids in the beginning were like, oh, you know, Sharon Tate slain, and her, you know, four of the friends slain,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden it was like a 180. Out of nowhere, it's like, well, they kind of deserved it, because they were a bunch of young rich kids, you know, having fun in the hills, and, you know, they had it coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this was an era of, like, hippies and free love and, you know, people experimenting. And I know that Sharon Tate and Mia Farrow were, like, the quintessential, like, they were these, like, hippies.
Yeah.
And hippies today is what you call a hipster. You know, I mean, they were like, you know, into yoga, they were reading the Bhagavad Gita,
mm-hmm.
they were, you know, just, you know, they were major icons.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, saw that and they were like, well, they had it coming, you know, they
it's
put themselves.
It's the ultimate victim blaming.
It is. Mm. It's so sickening, because it still happens to this very day. It's a media circus. It's a circus. It is. It's disgusting.
And to have to, I just think, like, you're already having to grieve.
Yeah.
You've lost someone in the worst imaginable way.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to defend their legacy because of, oh, it's just heartbreaking.
It's
I just
so
think,
heartbreaking, yeah.
Of course, the murders themselves, of course, like, that is the true tragedy, but I just think Mia Farrow just breaks my heart. Like, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. this is, you know, and then of course, like, her entire life is intertwined with Roman Polanski,
mm-hmm.
which it would have been anyway.
Right.
But now it's just so heartbreaking that this is, like, part of her legacy, and mm-hmm. that this is something that this, you know, cliche cross to bear has been thrust upon her. It's just so crazy.
It's really sad. And it wasn't just the Sharon Tate murders, too.
Mm-hmm.
They committed another one.
Right. So,
like, literally, like, right
wrapping
after.
Wrapping it up, yes. So they, all that happens, the poor housekeeper finds them the mm-hmm. next day. So, it, of course, there's an investigation. And then, who is it? I think it was Watson, or I'm sorry, Atkins was already in prison for, they were arrested for the auto.
Mm-hmm.
But the next day, allegedly, Charles Manson is mad because it didn't go quite as smoothly as had been planned.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all this planned, coordinated violence. And because it had an element of chaos, because there was a boy there that they weren't expecting, because the groundskeeper came up and like sort of surprised them, mm-hmm. because they escaped and almost got away. There's like these little loose ends, and he's mad, and he's so then he has them go the next day to just a random grocer and his wife, mm-hmm. and they are also murdered in an equally violent manner. And it's, again, just a statement murder done in just a horrific way, not even 24 hours later. Obviously, this is all pieced together mm-hmm. much later, because they don't initially indict the Manson family
no.
on these murders. It's later when they start piecing together the, okay, well, she's been confessing to her cellmate, and we had the murder weapon in the wheel well of this car, which was stolen. It all starts coming together, and they realize the scope of these few days and how violent and quick the turnaround was. And so then that starts the sort of media legal circus of extraditing them back to LA, mm-hmm. and, you know, can he be charged because he didn't technically kill anybody?
Right.
What do you do when it's a cult murder? And all of this sort of groundbreaking kind of work, because things like this just hadn't occurred yet. And so it is in so many ways the first of its kind. Not the first historically, but the most iconic, because there's just so many layers of like detective work that has to be done, and the timeline that has to be created, mm-hmm. the legal process that has to be pursued, and yeah. it just takes so much work to finally convict them. And then obviously, like,
it did. It took them, like, I think I read it took them 2 to 3 years,
which is just so
to
crazy.
Sentence them, because like the court hearings, that's another episode right there. I mean, it was intense. Like, it was a show. For them, that was a show. It's yeah. like, well, I'm just going to carry on with this. I'm going to smile and taunt yeah. and do everything.
It was all part of their mindset, mm-hmm. their plan. And it's just, I mean, so earth-shattering to see these people just completely remorseless, completely convinced that what they did was good. And then, you know, thankfully they were convicted.
Yeah, they were convicted. But what surprises me, too, is, like, they were still trying to push for parole.
Oh, 100%.
They were like, oh, I found Jesus, and oh. I'm really sorry. And no. It, like, I promise you guys that it was mm-hmm. the acid. The acid made me mm-hmm. do it. No, it's, you did it.
The women especially, yeah.
it was intentional, you know? Mm-hmm. You were on a mission. And, it was really, really sad.
It is. But it's just, from all angles, it's just so... Because, of course, like, they were brainwashed. They were. So it is sad, but you're still accountable. There's still literal blood on your hands. Mm-hmm. Like, oof.
Now, I know that, I think I read, like, Susan Atkins died in prison. Mm-hmm. She died, I think, not too long ago, in 2009 mm-hmm. or 2010. And I think she had cancer, like, brain cancer. Karma.
I know.
But the other ones are still rotting in jail. I know, mm-hmm. like, Tex is still rotting in jail, and the other women are rotting in jail as well.
Yeah.
I know there was another woman who was a lookout. I think her first name was, like, Lindsay, but her nickname was Squeaky.
Gotta love a good nickname.
All right, if you're going to have someone as a lookout with a name Squeaky...
one of many problems.
Yeah, and she, like, she is the only one, from what I've read, that had, you know, better intention. She was like, this is wrong. Mm. And I think she even, like, I think she left the ranch after the murders occurred.
Mm.
She, like, ran away. Picked up her kid, mm-hmm. ran away. And then later, like, was brought in to testify. Because she was, like, the vital witness. She mm-hmm. was like, I was a lookout. And mm-hmm. in order for her to save face and save her ass, they told her, look, we're going to make a deal with you. You're going to have to testify.
Yeah.
And for her, it was really scary. You think it would be easy? No, because she had to sit in front of, you know, the three women mm-hmm. and Manson, who were taunting her throughout the whole process. Taunting her, staring at her, making faces. It was tough, but she was like, no, I got to do this.
Yeah. Which it's one of those things, like, maybe a little too late, mm-hmm. but at least she finally,
you know, testified.
Did what was right. Oh, my goodness. Finally. you're a little late to the party.
Exactly.
thanks.
But I mean, man, every time I hear the story, I get goosebumps.
I know. It really is so iconic. You know what's really crazy
is that it happened 30 minutes away from where we are. Because, like, guys, we live in LA, but we live in the valley. And to get to where this location is, like, you just go through, you know, Coldwater Canyon.
Just right up over.
Yeah. Just a hop, skip away, and you're there in, like, literally 30 minutes.
And I think that is why this is such a good one for our first episode, because it's so intertwined with the city. You know what I mean? It really is such an iconic... I mean, you can take the Star Tour and see where it happened and see the Manson House. And
oh, my God, yes. My friend did those Star Tours, and she's like, girl, we saw, like, the house where the
Tapers happened. Of course. It's a huge industry. Like,
yeah.
It's so iconic to the decade, to the city, to pop culture. I mean, how many movies and bad Lifetime TV shows have been made based on this?
There are, like, tons. There were tons.
Because tons it was that. It really, in so many ways, was the end of innocence in our country.
Made the perfect Hollywood crime story.
Yeah.
Made the perfect Hollywood crime story.
Oof.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Oh, yeah. I know. What lighthearted fare. Like.
Now it's going to get even weirder. Yeah. So to start off with this, guys, we're going to go into the paranormal aftermath of the Sharon Tate Manson murders. So this is where it gets weirder. And to start off with this, usually in cases like this, when something traumatic happens, when something very violent and serious happens, something's always left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very physical, and you could feel it. It's not just a memory. It's there. It's an energy. And a lot of times, it's a manifestation of that energy. And for this case, you know, we see this happen, and it's documented. So this is the paranormal aftermath of Sharon Tate and the Manson family murders. So the date is 1999. David Oman is a private investigator, and he's living in LA. You know, he's not happy with his job. He's just pretty much chasing cheating husbands. And one day in November, he gets a call from his father, and he tells him, David, you better get your ass up and over here at this property. It's a foreclosure property. It's gonna go into auction. Bryce, you're gonna, like, freak out.
Oh no.
The property is going for $40,000
in oh my god. Okay.
In Benedict Canyon. Guys, if you're not from here, let me give you a broad overview of Benedict Canyon. It's the hills. It's where a lot of, like, wealthy people who have an insane amount of money live. It's very, very secluded. It's gated. I mean, it's humongous homes, like tri-level homes. Add four zeros to the $40,000.
Oh, $40,000 would buy you a trash can.
It would buy you an 8x8 plot of dirt and maybe a sprig of grass growing.
But the grass will be extra. 100%.
They would charge you an extra fee for that. They'll tax you on that grass.
Oh my goodness. So you drop whatever you're doing and get there immediately.
So David tells his father, okay, well, give me the address. And the father gives him the address, and he's like, wait, Cielo Drive. He's like, Dad, that's literally right next to where the Sharon Tate murders occurred. And the father's like, I don't care, just get your ass over here. $40,000, just get your ass over here. So they bid on the property. They buy it for $40,000.
Oh my God.
Jesus Christ. I know. Like, I still can't get over that. But this is 1998-99. So they buy the property, and they immediately break ground, because David's dad is big into real estate.
Sure.
He is a big commercial real estate individual in this community. So they know what to do. They get everything started. So shit is already happening during the construction of this house.
Oh.
And David even shares this in a movie that he had written based on true and inspired events that occurred, you know, while the house was being constructed and while with him living in the house. But in David's story, he says during the construction of the house, workers were experiencing a lot of crazy stuff already. So there were stories that were lingering from workers to worker, from worker to worker. They were hearing voices. They would hear phantom footsteps. One worker even documented saying, yeah, I was working in this room. I was painting this room, getting it all set up. It was hot, hot, hot that day. It was like probably 101 degrees. Out of nowhere, the temperature lowers. It goes immediately, like what felt like 40 or 50 degrees. And he was like, yeah, I was sweating, you know, while working in this room, and it just turned cold. And then he gets this sudden feeling that he is being watched, that someone else is in the room with him. So he immediately turns around. No one's there. He's a little freaked out. So he starts to go up the stairs. As he's walking up the stairs, he hears what sounds like footsteps following him. And he stops and he turns around. He's like, I swear to God, there was someone right behind me. But in the midst of this process of building this home, workers were even quitting because they were getting so freaked out with all the shit that was going on.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So finally, it's 2001, 2002. The house is finally done. And the house, like many homes, guys, in this area, because when you're living in the hills, it's not like you just build a house and that's it. These are like tri-level homes. Mm-hmm. They're literally built on outlines. They're built on a hill. So, I mean, you have all it looks like a ginormous like apartment building. Mm-hmm. A lot of these homes, they have like 3 to 4 levels. Mm-hmm. And I know with David's house, it's a tri-level home. So he has the first, second, and third floor. The third floor hits the base of the hill. Yeah, it gets better. So immediately, he starts to experience a lot of crap going on in the house right after he moves into the house. Mm. So the biggest story that David shares with his first paranormal experience in that house is he was sleeping in one of the rooms and he was like in a heavy sleep. Mm-hmm. And he wakes up between the hours of 3 and 4 a.m. in the morning.
It always is between the hours of
3 and 4. The witch, it's the devil's hour.
The devil's hour.
And he is awakened out of his deep sleep, and he looks over to the corner of his room, and he sees a young gentleman dressed in what looks like a suit. It's like, mm-hmm. Looks like it was from the 50s or 60s. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman looks younger. He's looking, you know, straight at David, just completely just, you know, dead stare. And David's telling him, like, who are you? Are you, what are you doing here? He thought he was dreaming. He thought someone broke in. And this gentleman is just standing there in the foot of his bed. Then he reaches his left arm outwards and points directly out to the window, pointing to the direction of where the Sharon Tate house stood. And David's, like, trying to talk to whoever this person was. And he's like, what are you doing here? And the guy is just pointing out of the window and not saying anything. Just completely reticent. And then finally, the guy disappears.
Mm-mm.
And is gone. Yes. I mean, I'm trying to, like, put myself in David's position. Like, what would you do if, like, a ghost woke you up?
Well, and that's the thing, too, is, like, that weird, like, half-awake,
yeah.
Your logical brain doesn't kick in. Because my instinct sitting here in your kitchen right now is, like, run. You just run. But, like, when you, like, burn the house, it's not worth it. $40,000 isn't worth it.
I mean, right.
But when you're in that moment, you're trying to
rationalize.
Who are you? Like, what are you pointing at? Like, you're trying to rationalize with a ghost, yeah. Sir, like, get out. But you don't think like that.
No, you just don't. Let's do a little scene, Bryce.
Oh my god.
Let's do. Okay, all right. Do you want to play the ghost or?
Sure, I'll just point.
All right. Okay. You play the ghost, and I'm David waking up. All right. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Scene. Let's start. Oh shit! This is happening. You're pointing. Okay. Obviously. Like, this is not a Tinder date. Like, I didn't bring it back.
I did not swipe left on a ghost.
Oh, shit. I should have.
I love it. Oh, my God.
For me, I would be in that rationalized
state. It's when
state.
They move, yeah. Too. The pointing and the, like.
But why are they so damn dramatic?
Like, I don't know.
Like, why can't, like, hey, like, I'm coming from this area. I don't know. Like, why so dramatic? Unless, that's one thing I really want to look into as well, is, like, why are they not so, like, extremely communicative, mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I think it has to fall along the lines of as the energy it must take to cross whatever barrier is between us and the afterlife must be so high,
right,
that you would communicate in whatever way you could.
That's
right. True. So they're not, I don't think you would be able to form like a full thought or a full sentence or even mm-hmm. be able to speak. Maybe that's all you would be able to do is like point or make a noise or right. something. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
That I mean, is true.
Like, I have so many varied thoughts about like what I really believe in terms of ghosts. But I think that definitely is a huge part of it, is that the barrier is there for a reason, and to cross that barrier must take an exorbitant amount of energy, and so you communicate in whatever way. And of course it would be dramatic because mm-hmm. it's already such a high stakes situation. Right. I don't know.
Yeah, no, but that's true, because they have to absorb entities have to absorb energy around them to manifest, which segues me into what we're going to find out more about this location, and not just the house, but just the location. So in doing research, David Omen's house is built smack dab in the middle of a geomagnetic anomaly.
Oh, David, which what are you thinking?
I know, what are 40,000.
Yeah,
it was,
I mean,
40,000 his dad bought.
Like, I hope it was worth it.
But I wonder if he could claim that in taxes. Oh, so it's built like smack dab in the middle of this geomagnetic field, this anomaly, or as some people like to call it, a vortex.
Oh my goodness.
So it is pretty much it's absorbing so much energy. It's like, it's a major energy hotspot.
Uh-huh.
So it attracts other energies from outside. Not only that, David soon discovers, as he's trying to research what happened to him that night, he finds out that the gentleman at the foot of his bed matches the same identity to one of the victims of the Sharon Tate murders.
No.
So it matches to the T, J.C. Bring.
Oh my goodness. And who's the writer and was friends with Roman Polanski, in case anyone forgot?
Oh no, that was...
Is that not the writer?
No.
Don't listen to anything I say.
J.C. Bring was the celebrity hairstylist.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
Wojciech Rakowski, I believe that's how you pronounce it. He was, yeah, the writer, Playboy, and really good friends with Roman, but...
Good fact checking.
But he also had, like, a romantic connection, too, with Sharon Tate.
Right.
And that's where Sharon comes along. There's been also other instances where David has made communication and has seen Sharon Tate around the property. So she has been seen on the property. She has been known to, you know, tap people on the shoulder, to sing, to even whisper in, you know, several people's ears if they're visiting his home. I mean, she makes herself very, very well known. So her and Jay are the big, big entities in the house. And I know that he's also made communication with Abigail Folger, not so much with Wojciech, but those are primarily the main entities that he is in constant communication with. But then he, as he's researching what happened next door, as he's researching to who he saw, which was J.C. Bring, in the middle of his research, this guy finds out that the land that he bought, the land that his home is built to add more salt to this wound, the land is an Indian burial ground.
Stop. No, it is not.
It's like Poltergeist vibes.
No.
The movie Poltergeist all over again. I mean, it is legit a burial ground, because just literally several feet from where his house is built, there's a plaque that says, here is the, you know, location where the war between the Tongva tribe and the Californian, the group of early Californian settlers,
this is
where they fought.
I'm sure.
This is where they perished. And primarily the tribe, I think they lost, and everyone that was killed in that tribe is buried there.
Oh my goodness. That is just... a perfect storm. Like, just, oh my goodness.
He got what he paid for, you know?
And more.
There's a lot more.
No.
Oh God, it doesn't stop with this man. It really doesn't. So he has these entities who match the description of the victims of the Sharon Tate murders. He has poltergeist activity occurring in his home. So one of the stories is he's having a housewarming party. This is like the first week he moved in. He's having a legit housewarming party. People are drinking. They're having a good time in the living room and kitchen area. Out of nowhere, a bottle of red wine just is thrown against the wall. No one is around the table. People stop in the middle of the party. The music, like legit stops.
Yeah.
Everyone turns around. They look at the wall. They're looking at the smash bottle. And David's like, I don't even know what happened. You know, it's insane. In my opinion, I think maybe the poltergeist just doesn't like red wine.
And,
you guys should have had some, like, Riesling or something.
Yes, I don't know. How dare you? In this house?
In this house? So, that happened. So, to please that entity, mm-hmm. and it's in his website, guys. If you go to www.theomenhouse.com, you can see actual footage of his home, like the interior of his home. So if you go on the tri-level, which is the level that's on the base of the hill of his home,
mm-hmm.
it's like almost like a basement. You can see like the actual dirt. There's like the hill. You see the hill. Mm-hmm. It's all open.
Mm-hmm.
And they're what is like known as gifts that people have placed on this ground in his third level. And people have brought gifts of fruit and tobacco to please the spirits of the Tongva tribe. Because it is legit their burial ground.
Right.
They perished. They battled. They perished. They are buried here in this, you know, earth.
Oh my goodness. That is crazy.
Yes. So a lot of energy is mainly felt in the third floor. And a lot of shit flies. People have felt, you know, their hair or, you know, being like grabbed, being pulled, being pushed. It happens. There is an area in his third level too, which is the bedroom where he was sleeping in, where he saw JC bring. It's an intense room. People that go in there do not feel a good energy. Mm-hmm. They feel a heavy weight. They feel like so much stuff is going on in that room. They had a documentary crew staying there. They were filming a documentary on his house. Mm-hmm. One of the guys who was like a boom operator, he was a big man, huge, 6 feet tall. He was like, I'm going to sleep in this room. I really don't believe in any of this shit. And ends up waking up what felt like someone grabbing him by the neck and pulling him against the wall out of bed
The
opposite corner of the room. Yeah. So this room is highly active, highly intense. It is one of the most most investigated part of his home. David Omen has gone as far as to opening his home for individuals to come in and experience all the stuff that he's experiencing. And he's even opened up his home to Ghost Adventures, a ton of other shows, shows from overseas. You can even go on the website, The Omen House, and make reservations to go to his house. I'd be down.
Well, you're braver than me. I'd
be down. I feel like if we go there with our Starbucks cups, it's like, sorry.
Haunt me if you must, but please do not spill my Starbucks. Like,
I know.
Pull me out of bed, but don't spill my coffee. Thank you. Priorities.
Sorry, we're not Folger fans, but...
No. Well, I'll drink anything. Like, come on.
But here's another thing, too, that I read about David Omen. He is a collector. He collects a ton of memorabilia.
Oh.
And there's another room where it's just a wall covered with footballs and helmets. He's a big, like, football fan. Mm-hmm. And he also has these boxing gloves, this collection of, like, boxing memorabilia that belonged to actual boxers back in the day. And paranormal, clairvoyants, they go in there, and say, hey, you know, we are also seeing a vision of this boxer.
No.
It's attached not to the home, but is attached to one of your pieces of memorabilia.
He brought it with him.
His home is like, it's like, you know, an adoptive home for spirits. It's like, come over here. You know, you want to haunt something? Come in and haunt my house, you know?
Oh, David, what are you thinking?
My door's always open, pretty much. And then there was another story where, because his family, they do a lot of real estate. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of great connections. They know a lot of people. And it turned out that a close family friend of theirs had passed away. He was a famous film star in the 50s. Mm-hmm. He passes away. they have an estate sale. They give David some pieces of his furniture, and David's like, "Oh yeah, I'll take some of his furniture." You know, not even thinking, you know, what could be attached. No. So they move the furniture into one of the rooms, mm-hmm. and people that are sleeping in this room can see the spirit of, you know, the actor that, you know, owned this furniture. And it's just this ongoing thing. Right. Like, he's like, "I don't mind. This guy honestly lives by himself. He lives with his, I think his two dogs and two or three cats. So he honestly, like, he does not mind living with these entities.
What?
And
that's the craziest part. That's literally the craziest thing you said.
In a quote of his, in an interview, he says, you know, "I fear the living more than I fear the dead. If anything, the dead, you know, they're here to communicate.
Mm.
They're here because they want to be heard. They have unfinished business, and I'm here to listen." So for him, like, if you go on his website, I promise you guys, like, you'll see video of him, like, interacting with them. You see actual orbs. You see weird stuff going on. There's this intense video. You see this black shadow leaving the house through the front door. It's so intense.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, people have visited. They have said, you know, if you're a skeptic, you're going to come out a believer. People have seen and felt so much within the first, like, 15 minutes of walking throughout the whole property. And not to mention a famous paranormal scientist by the name of Barry Taff. If you do not know his name, you should know this. If you're a para nerd and you understand and have read the story, which we will cover in one of our future episodes, is called The Entity. And it was the haunting in Culver City where this woman was haunted by this random entity out of nowhere.
Oh, my goodness.
And it, like, abused her, even raped her. It was a big, big story. It was a book that was turned into a movie. And Barry Taff was the scientist that pretty much was the one to study it and be a part of it. So he went into this house. And it's even in one of the episodes of Ghost Adventures. He goes in and he instantly feels terrible.
Oof.
He said, like, this is just the most intense home he's ever worked in. He calls it the Disneyland of the dead.
Oh, that is just horrifying. Oh, no.
I mean, there are spirits at Disneyland.
Yes.
I mean, it's been legit documented, but he calls it the Disneyland of the dead because it's like the dead roam around here and they speak and they interact with you and they make themselves very, very known. So, you know, that's the paranormal aftermath of Sharon Tate.
Sure.
And not to mention, this is probably in connection with it too, but I found out through reading and doing research about his home that her house was torn down in 94.
Oh, wow.
And they rebuilt another one. So maybe, I know that, like, whenever you go into a house with so much energy or when something has happened, something traumatic has happened in it, you're waking up different energies. And when people do renovations or remodels, something is, like, misconstrued in the house, you're pretty much pissing that energy off.
Oh my goodness.
You're releasing something. So maybe, in my theory, when they tore down her home, something was unleashed.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that David comes in and builds this house in the middle of this geogrid attracts that. And I feel too that a lot of us do carry, like, a sixth sense. Maybe he has a very strong sixth sense. Mm-hmm. I think maybe he is an empath because he, you know, communicates with them on a daily basis.
Wow.
It's really, really, really intense.
Yeah. Maybe think about selling your house. I don't know. it might be time.
I feel like he will die in that house. Like, he is going to, like, forever live there and then most likely haunt that house. He will be hanging out with them in spirit, literally.
Yeah.
It's insane. But, so that is the paranormal aftermath of the Omen House and Sharon Tate murders.
That is a lot.
Yeah. It's an intense story, and, I mean, there's so much documentation.
And I think you hit the nail on the head of just, like, when there's everything is echoed, you know what I mean? And I never quite know. Sometimes I hear these things, and I just think that there has to be an explanation. I'm such a logical kind of person.
Right.
And so I just think, like, there must be something. But when you look at it and the violence that set everything off, that echoes you know, there's just so much chaos and energy, like you were saying. And however that manifests itself, you can then see these things that are just mirrors of what has happened before. And so now all of this is happening. It's like, well, of course, like you were saying, that of course it's happening. Mm-hmm. It echoed through. And that is just so crazy.
I know.
Oof. It's weird. Can never go there ever.
I want to go. I know. I'm all like,
oh. You can Skype me and I'll sit in, I don't know, a church somewhere and watch it, cry in a corner. It'll be fine.
I'll be drinking some, you know, holy water while watching it.
And then they spill it. Ugh. Stop throwing my holy water against the wall, ghosts.
You're blessing the place.
I know.
Want me to give a prayer out?
I wonder, has he ever tried to... Or he doesn't mind, so he's not tried to, like, sage it or exorcise it or...
No, nothing, actually. If anything, his experience is, like, what we said before. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a town of entertainment. He's going to make a profit.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
This is what I hate about some of these individuals that go into a setting like this. They know what they have. They see how people are attracted to something like this, and they make a profit out of it. That's something that really bothers me. But for in his situation, he's very respectful.
Mm-hmm.
Like he opens his home, and he's very passionate about, you know, the history mm-hmm. of that property. He's very respectful of it, and you know, he does communicate with it in a way where, you know, it's like he's known them all of his mm-hmm. life, and it's just so amazing how, like, this also inspired him to write a script.
Whoa.
So he ends up doing a movie.
Okay.
It's called The House at the End of the Drive. And it has executive producers from the Amityville Horror that are working in this, you know, project with him. And it's inspired by actual events. Whoa. Not word for word, everything that you see there, you know, actually happened. But, I mean, there are some, you know, scenes in there where he really did legit go through them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not Oscar worthy work.
It's
a bit of a B film, but all that information is on his website, and you can also find more information at the house at the end of the drive.com if you're interested in seeing that movie. But I think he filmed that movie several years ago.
Okay.
And I mean, he's documenting everything and pretty much living through it to this very day.
Ugh. Maybe sell the house. I don't know. Let's
keep that on the table. Would cost?
He would certainly get his $40,000 back.
Yeah. And more. And a lot more.
And then some, yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I know. That is our episode one of our Hollywood True Crime and Paranormal Aftermath of Sharon Tate and the Manson Murders. Thank you all for tuning in.
Our first episode.
Sorry. Make sure to follow us on Twitter. We are at HWP Podcast. And we are also on Instagram and Facebook at Holly Weird Paranormal. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Well, that was weird. And it's going to get even weirder. Thanks for listening to Holly Weird Paranormal. Be sure to visit our blog at hollyweirdparanormal.com to learn more about the podcast, this past episode, your hosts, and more.
And if you liked our podcast and you want to listen to more, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. You want to stalk us some more? Then follow us on Instagram and Facebook at hollyweirdparanormal. You can also follow us on Twitter at HWP Podcast.
Have an idea for a future episode or would like to submit one of your own for a listener's episode? Then you can shoot them over to our blog at hollyweirdparanormal.com or directly through email through hollyweirdparanormal@gmail.com.